Next up, State versus Streepy.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sarah Tabuada, and I represent Mr. Streepy in this matter. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The trial court deprived Mr. Streepy of his sixth...
I just need a seventh grader to help me with this.
So once again, the trial court deprived Mr. Streepy of his Sixth Amendment rights, not once, but twice throughout the course of his trial. And for this reason, this court should reverse Mr. Streepy's convictions and remand for a new trial. First, the trial court deprived Mr. Streepy of his Sixth Amendment right to confront and cross-examine the witnesses against him when it admitted the testimonial statements of SG. The Confrontation Clause demands that a defendant possess the ability to confront those who bear testimony against him. And additionally, when circumstances effectively indicate that an ongoing emergency no longer exists and the purpose of the interrogation is simply to prove past events that are relevant to future prosecution, then those statements are, of course, testimonial.
What's the test or what's the question that the U.S. Supreme Court asks us or directs us to answer in determining whether something's testimonial?
Whether somebody... So the test that the court established in Crawford, it's whether somebody gives a solemn oath to bear testimony or to say something that will be relevant for future prosecutions.
In Ohio versus Clark, a couple of years ago, the Supreme Court sort of tried to consolidate all of its prior decisions. And it reinforced that the question we look at is whether, in light of all of the circumstances, viewed objectively, the primary purpose of the conversation was to create an out-of-court substitute for trial testimony.
Correct.
So with that as our target, how does the young person here, objectively viewed, differ from the young person in Clark?
I'm not 100% familiar with the circumstances in Clark, but what I do know is that I don't believe that the court or our Supreme Court has created a per se rule where children are unable to give testimonial statements. I don't really think that that's what the court's objective was in that case. However, I do think an objective analysis here, particularly under Koslowski, shows us that there was no ongoing emergency at the time.
When you reference our Supreme Court, I'm not sure which one you were
referring. United States Supreme Court.
So what the U.S. Supreme Court tells us is that the declarant's age fortifies our conclusion that the statements in question were not testimonial. Statements by very young children will rarely, if ever, implicate the Confrontation Clause. Rather, the research on children's understanding of the legal system finds that young children have little understanding of prosecution. A young child in these circumstances would simply want the abuse to end, would want to protect other victims, or would have no discernible purpose at all. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court is saying about when young children utter statements that are subject to Confrontation Clause analysis. And it's an objective standard, so it isn't what's in that child's mind at that moment, even. So given that fleshing out of the question,
correct.
How do we view the child here and his situation with regard to whether he was attempting to make statements in order to facilitate a later prosecution or whether he had some other purpose or no purpose at all in mind?
I think under these circumstances, the officer's questioning and the answers that SG was delivering to the officer were to retell past events, and they were used for future prosecution. I believe the case that you referred to, was that the one with the three-year-old child?
That was the one with the preschooler.
Preschooler. Okay. So in these circumstances, the child was 7 years old. I believe that the police officer was eliciting testimony from him. Of course, a seven-year-old might not have an understanding of what a trial is like, or might not have an understanding of the fact that there are testimony could be elicited at a future criminal prosecution,
so
but I think
is that irrelevant if he doesn't have such an understanding?
No, I don't think. I don't think it's irrelevant. You can certainly take into account the age of the child, but I think objectively under these circumstances, where there was no ongoing emergency, again under Keselowski, the statements here were certainly testimonial.
Ongoing emergency. I know that everybody wants to grasp onto that. But that really, that's whether there's an ongoing emergency is just a subset of this other inquiry. It's just one way that objectively viewing people's behavior, it may explain why they don't have a primary purpose of giving trial testimony in advance of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
I'm waiting for what is there about this child that we would look at objectively viewing the hypothetical reasonable child in his position,
mm-hmm.
for an object, that would lead us to conclude that this child had in mind talking to the officer in order to facilitate a criminal prosecution rather than some other purpose.
Well, I think he knew at that point that the situation was over, that the, you know, whatever was happening at the time.
The situation was over.
Well, Mr. Streepy was separated and handcuffed and outside of the home.
Where does it say that he knew that Mr. Streepy was handcuffed?
It doesn't say that anywhere, but the circumstances in, if you go through, I believe, we don't know exactly what.
Mr. Streepy was outside with an entirely different officer, so he had no, there's nothing in the record that gives us any indication that he knew that Mr. Streepy was handcuffed.
But he knew that Mr. Streepy was outside and that he was separated from Ms. Gudino, who was his mother.
And
so
Mr. Streepy had not been arrested. Did he know that Mr. Streepy had not yet been arrested?
He didn't know that he'd been arrested, but he did know that.
Well, he hadn't been arrested.
He hadn't been arrested, no.
Right. Right.
But he did know that the situation was over in the sense that whatever had occurred, whatever had transpired that he had allegedly witnessed at the time.
What would you think would happen if the officers just left?
If the officers had just left?
Just left Mr. Streepy there. What would we assume that a reasonable 7-year-old would conclude if the officers just left?
So you're saying that the police left the scene?
Yeah. There's no indication that this 7-year-old has any notion of mandatory arrest in domestic violence cases,
well,
right?
Right. But again,
so if the police just left, what would he think would happen?
I don't know, but
Wouldn't he think that what would happen is that the violence would resume?
You know, we only have his
testimonial
statement.
So the reason for him talking to the police officer was to make sure the violence stopped, not to facilitate a later prosecution.
No, I don't. I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Your Honor, Michael Safestrom on behalf of the State of Washington, the respondent in this matter. I'd like to talk about, if I have time, two primary issues. First of all, the issue of whether or not the statements of SG, the 7-year-old boy, were testimonial or non-testimonial, and then the issue of impeachment with immigration status for a domestic violence victim. I'd like to just address the subject the court was just discussing. I actually agree with counsel for Mr. Streepy on one point, which is that this is not a subjective inquiry. We're not looking at what is exactly in the mind of the 7-year-old boy when he speaks, but we do look at objectively all of the circumstances.
We're looking at it objectively. We're assuming he's a reasonable 7-year-old boy because when we view things objectively, we have to impose a reasonableness standard.
Sure.
And it's based on all of the circumstances that included what is the information that the utterer would know at the time of the utterance, right?
And the state agrees, Your Honor.
Okay.
To address the court's question just a second ago, Mr. Streepy argues that the 7-year-old boy knew that it was over, knew that the abuse was over. Not only is that unreasonable, Your Honor, that would have been an unreasonable conclusion from the perspective of a reasonable 7-year-old boy. Here we have a situation where abuse has begun at some point during the night with the boy present. He was present in the bed when the events began to transpire. He was sent out of the room because his mother knew what was going to happen. He then returned to the room to witness his mother being abused in a violent way. He screamed, he cried as he saw what was happening. His mother escaped, called the police, and then Brian Streepy returned after Ms. Godino was done with her first 911 call. Mr. Streepy was again irate, and Ms. Godino left the bathroom so she could draw him away from the children. So the children are very much part of this entire incident. And we have essentially two periods of assault that are occurring here prior to law enforcement arrival. So what we're talking about, when SG is speaking to Officer Clements inside the apartment moments after the last period of assault ended, is not the potential for a second incident of abuse that night. We're talking about a third incident of abuse that night. So it would have been unreasonable for this child to think that somehow, once the cop showed up the first time, that everything was done and he was safe. Given his demeanor at the time...
Well, what's the end to that paragraph that you just uttered? That isn't the end to that paragraph unless the police left with Mr. Streepy rather than the police leaving and leaving Mr. Streepy at the home. Right?
Yes, Your Honor, and I don't think that a 7-year-old really thinks about it in those terms. I think a case that's on point here that's helpful and looking at these issues would be the State v. Reed opinion. In that case, this court determined that one of the reasons why a reasonable speaker in the position of the declarant would have said the things she said to law enforcement after they had arrived in response to her 911 call was that the presence of an officer only provides temporary protection. This is a fleeting situation. It's an opportunity for a victim or the child of a victim to say what they have to say to get protection, to let the officers know what's actually going on. Looking at this from another perspective, looking at it from a law enforcement perspective, it's not just SG that wants law enforcement to know what's going on. The cops also need to know what's going on for their own safety and for the safety of everyone else that's there. A case on point that's somewhat analogous, I think, is the Perez case from this court in 2014. In that situation, we have a somewhat distinguishable set of facts. It's a prison assault, police-dominated atmosphere. Yet the trial court in that case, which was affirmed by this court, indicated that the job of law enforcement there, even after the parties had been separated, this is even after the potential suspect was removed from the scene of the crime, removed from the victim, even then, law enforcement had a duty to find out what was going on, to assess the situation. Only way to assess a situation like that in Perez, or like the situation before the court today, is to get information. And the information exists in the minds of the participants to the conflict. So the way that Officer Clements went about getting that necessary information is by talking to those people. It doesn't have to be a long conversation. It doesn't have to be a formal interview. It doesn't have to be recorded in any way. But what he had to do is he had to talk to those people inside the apartment, and he had to do it quickly. That's what he did.
Let me ask you about the immigration status issue. I'll call her the victim because he's been convicted. The victim testified that it was her personal belief, her subjective belief, that she was in the United States legally because of the DACA status. Is that correct?
I believe so. There was a number of terms that were thrown around. I think legal might have been one of them. It's probably not the best term of art to use.
Well, I'm not talking about whether or not a lawyer or a judge would conclude the same thing. I'm talking about what she believed herself about her personal circumstances.
Yes, and that was her belief, Your Honor.
So if at the time she spoke to the officers on the scene and at the time she testified in court, her belief was that she was in the United States legally, why does any of the rest of this that's been briefed matter?
I'm not sure if I understand the question.
Well, so if her state of mind was that I don't need a U visa, I'm not in danger of being deported, I'm in the United States legally. I mean, nobody argues this, but I'm asking you, I mean, this is my did I miss that day in school question. If her state of mind is none of this matters to me, then why does everything that's been briefed about what her correct status was or might have been or how she might have changed her thing, how does any of that matter?
It doesn't.
Okay.
It doesn't, because what matters, well, Your Honor, this is not an immigration case. It's not a case about nationality. It's not a case about whether or not Ms. Gudina was lawfully in the United States, or maybe I should say not unlawfully in the United States, as Department of Homeland Security would refer to it. The question is credibility. That was the issue at trial. Immigration was not a trial issue. The question of credibility.
Now, you'd agree if she had testified at trial differently, or somehow at variance with what she said to the officers at the scene. And if she testified, yes, I learned about this U visa in between those times. And if she had testified, I'm temporarily allowed to stay in the United States pursuant to DACA, but I'm not really here legally, then under those circumstances, then it would be, then her immigration status, her desire, her potential desire to have a U visa might be admissible to explain the variation in her testimony and her motive to do that.
I agree 100%. I think that the relevance of immigration status and U visa eligibility would be dramatically increased if there was a substantial change in testimony. For example, if she initially reported something that might amount to an assault in the fourth degree, and then at trial she described, you know, a gun held to her head or something like that, that would be a situation where the U visa eligibility would become more relevant.
Well, the reason I'm not pressing this, but the reason I bring it up is both because how it was briefed and because of the nature of Judge Churchill's decision, because Judge Churchill said it's minimally relevant, but it's outweighed by other things. And I don't see where it's relevant at all under the surrounding circumstances.
And Your Honor, that was my argument at the trial court level. It was actually the Honorable Judge Hancock who made the decision. But Judge Hancock, the way he phrased the relevance in this case was minimally relevant, if relevant at all. And I think the trial court went through the proper analysis and came to the proper conclusion when it comes to this question of relevance. What the trial court said is that there is a theoretical relevance here to the issue. For example, in a hypothetical case where a person is in danger, imminent danger of being deported, where they fear being deported, where, for example, they have not been authorized to remain in the United States by the Attorney General, or where they don't believe that they're authorized to remain. In those situations, fear of deportation could be a powerful motive.
Does it really come down to what they believe?
What it comes down to, Your Honor, is the contents of the witness's mind. That's what matters to credibility. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, just briefly, Your Honors. So I do agree that this was not a case about nationality. I think the relevance in Mr. Streepy being able to elucidate any sort of testimony regarding the relevance of Ms. Gudino's ability to obtain a U visa, as opposing counsel stated, was to sort of demonstrate her potential motive or bias for her testimony. And I do know that she did say that she did not know about the U visa program until a couple of months after this alleged incident transpired.
But if she testified that it was her belief that she was in the United States legally now, whether that was true or not, mm-hmm. That was her belief, how can the existence or non-existence of a U visa opportunity be connected in any way to her testimony, because her belief is that she wouldn't need it?
Well, sure, but I think it's something I do bring up in my reply to the state's response. I think that question should have been brought up to the jury, whether or not they wanted to believe the fact that she didn't know about the U visa program at trial, rather than having the trial court decide.
There's no evidence to the contrary.
But there is some evidence that she knew about the U visa after, and as the church...
Yeah, and if she had testified at variance with what she said at the scene, then certainly there would be a question, why did her testimony vary? But here she didn't testify, apparently.
She did not testify, but her testimony did not change dramatically at all, Your Honor. But what I do think is that, as the trial court said, the issue of her ability to obtain a U visa was relevant in the sense that it could, I don't know exactly what the quote was, but it was something to the effect of it could cause her to maybe exaggerate her testimony.
And that would matter if she had.
Right, but I think that question...
she didn't.
She didn't, but that question should have been given to the jury under these circumstances. The fact that she...
I don't understand. If there's no evidence that she exaggerated her testimony, why would we send that question to the jury? It's not at issue.
But what was at issue in this case was the credibility of both witnesses, because we had circumstances here where we had Ms. Scudino giving one narrative and we had Mr. Streepy giving another different narrative.
And if there was testimony that she knew about the U visa prior to the incident, that's a different fact. That might change things.
But there's evidence...
If there was testimony that she thought she was subject to deportation, that's a different fact, and that might change things. But under the facts that we have, what's the connection?
The connection that we have here is that there was some evidence that she knew about the U visa program, at least at one point during trial. So there was some evidence that this was something that she had knowledge about. And I know that I'm out of time, so I would just ask this court to please reverse Mr. Strickey's convictions. Thank you.
Next up is